You're listening to Alan James on Circle of White Light Radio and People's Internet Radio, focusing on solutions and thinking different.
Hello and welcome to Circle of White Light Radio with myself, Alan James. It's the 6th of December 2020. Welcome everybody in the chat room. It's a vaccine free zone on the chat rooms and you don't have to wear a mask in the chat room either. Isn't that fantastic? There's no signs on the outside of the chat room saying please put your mask on before you enter the chat room or please make sure you have your vaccine. It's vaccine free and mask free zone and it'll always stay like that. Right, good evening. Welcome everybody. Right, my guest on the show tonight is a chap who's been on OIM. It's been a while since I actually spoke to Pat on an actual interview on the radio. The last time I chatted with Pat, I think, on doing an interview was in May 2018, something like that, which was on OIM Radio. So this is the first time Pat's on Circle of White Light Radio. So it's great to have him on. We're going to get into politics and COVID and all that kind of stuff. So, and as you know, Pat Green is the leader of the DDI party, which is Direct Democracy Ireland. And Pat's on the chat room there as well. So he'll be seeing the questions and seeing you chatting to each other there on the chat room. Okay, so before we get into everything, let's find out what the communication channels are.
The communication channels are email, contact us at circleofwhitelight.com, by phone 046-927-1212, or sign up to our newsletter via our website at circleofwhitelight.com.
Okay, as usual, we're going to get into a few things before we bring the guest on. It's just incredible the amount of information and things that are going on. And I think my unscripted script is getting longer and longer every week with what's going on. And there's going to be a point where I just have to kind of call quits on it and just say, right, enough pages, because there's loads going on. But I'll give you the information we have anyway. Okay, so the independent.ie. They had an article in there and they said employers who ban staff from office for not getting vaccine are on shaky legal ground. So you all know there's a big push on for the vaccines, and obviously people who are working and in a job, people are concerned about their employers turning around and saying that you're going to have to get the vaccine or you won't be able to come in and do your job. And obviously for legal reasons they're saying that they're on shaky ground with that. Numerous vaccines are still being developed and are likely to be ready later this year or early next year, but there is no legal basis for mandatory vaccination policies, says one employment law expert. Not yet, but they're going to try. Employers who ban staff from the workplace who refuse to get a COVID-19 vaccine are on shaky legal ground, it has been warned. Employment law expert Alan Hickey said, there was no legal basis for mandatory vaccination policies. Not yet, but they'll push it. He said a company could face a discrimination claim if a worker was sanctioned for refusing to get a vaccine and told not to come into the office or be dismissed. He said it was an issue that was likely to be a big concern for employers, particularly in the health service and nursing homes, when the first COVID-19 vaccines become available. Numerous vaccines are still being developed and are likely to be ready later this year or early next year. As matters stand, our view is that employers would be on shaky ground if they seek to make vaccination a condition of employment, said Mr. Hickey, Services and Operation Director at Employment Law Consultancy. The decision to take a vaccine will ultimately be a personal one for the employee to make, and in the absence of a specific law dealing with the COVID-19 vaccine, employers don't appear to have any legal basis to adopt a mandatory vaccination policy. I think that's a very, very shaky ground, to be honest with you. Employers start demanding stuff like that, you know, it's a bit out of order. He said Irish citizens enjoyed a broad set of personal rights that were protected by the Constitution and European charters and conventions. Employees may not want to have a vaccine for many reasons. They may have been advised not to due to a pre-existing condition or because it could have a negative impact on their mental health. Workers could also object because of their religious beliefs or due to concerns about side effects. There you go. You might have something there. Side effects, religious beliefs and the constitution as well. He noted that protests by anti-mask and anti-vaccination activists were becoming more common, of course, because people are beginning to wake up and realise what's going on. Mr. Hickey said, although the government recommended various vaccine programmes, none were compulsory as of yet. Now, they can't, under the constitution anyway, they couldn't force you to actually have a vaccine, but they'll do it in a way like a TV licence or like a car licence or insurance that this is their plan anyway. Whether they get away with it, I don't know. We'll see what happens. But we'll see what we'll see how far they get. But they're getting desperate. They really are. With their fact checkers on Facebook and Google and everything else, they're getting so desperate now that they're trying to stop everybody exposing what's going on. Okay, another article in the Independent.ie. State to underwrite virus vaccine firms to reassure patients as UK approves Pfizer jab. National COVID-19 vaccination and implementation strategy now being planned. The government has agreed to indemnify the drug companies so they're not going to be liable if anything happens to your body if you get the vaccine. Isn't that nice? Producing COVID-19 vaccines against any liabilities that arise from complications with their rollout in the coming months. The move is considered standard practice, but is also a precondition of accessing doses of each of the company's vaccine and signals the government's confidence in the jabs being approved for quality, safety and efficiency by the European Medicines Agency in the coming weeks. Remember, folks, the government have no money. They have air money. So this money that they'll be dishing out to people who are damaged by the vaccine, and there will be people damaged by the vaccine, will be taxpayers' money. So it won't be the, obviously the farmers, the big farmer won't be using their money to pay for the any issues with the damage from the vaccine. It'll be the taxpayers' money. So yet again, we pay again. And then our generation, our younger generation, our kids and their kids' kids will have to pay tax on that to pay it all back. You see what happens. It's this is why governments need to be taken out. Okay, I did come across an FB post and I thought it was worthwhile reading it out. It says, the Pfizer COVID vaccine is approved in the UK and begins next week. But Pfizer has not provided the ingredients, the results data, an independently peer-reviewed study. To save you reading the 120-page study design, here's the summary. The vaccine has not been tested on children, pregnant women, people taking medications and individuals with other medical issues. As yet, the plan is for all of the above to receive the vaccine. Pfizer doesn't plan to release the results data for independent scrutiny for another 2 years. That's convenient. Pfizer did not assess vaccine reactions in all 43,000 participants, just a random subset of 8,000. Pfizer only reported severe reactions that occurred in more than 2%, 860 people. In other words, if 800 people suffered a severe immune reaction, they did not have to report it because it occurred in less than 2%. Pfizer will not submit the study for peer review until they've completed their analysis of safety data. Let that sink in. The vaccine is approved and they have not finished analysing the data. Now, the fact that they don't have a virus, the virus hasn't been isolated. So how can they have a vaccine for something that hasn't been isolated? You know, people need to start asking questions because it's just ridiculous how people are just accepting this. Oh, I'll take the vaccine, I'll step up and take the vaccine. And not, the logic doesn't seem to be applying. You know, whether it's fear or something else, I really, really don't know. But it's just getting madness why people can't even critically think and ask questions. Okay, so my week, just a few things. I came across this post during the week and I thought I'd read it out on air and just let people know this lady's experience. And this has got to do with the MMR, by the way. She said, my son fought for hours, but the new vaccine called MMR was too much for his little body. The attending surgeon cried as he told me how strong my son was and how he fought. I just remember how I couldn't do anything. The damage was done by the NHS, who coerced us into giving him the vaccine against our wishes, but now I'm called an anti-vax nutjob by the Prime Minister. I'd like to see Boris up close, please. R.I.P. Gage. Obviously, your son was called Gage. And this is the thing. So many stories of people having their kids damaged with vaccines like MMR or like HPV. And now, obviously, this is going to happen with this vaccine. And people still don't learn from these other people's experiences. It's unreal. Anyway, right. Okay, before I bring Pat in, I'm just going to say, at the end of the show, I have a pre-record with Cormac from the Pay It Forward team, who nominated the charity called Youth Suicide Prevention Ireland, which received €300 from the November donation. December's donation for €550 will be going towards Glenda and Feed the Homeless charity. Can you imagine being out in the storm that we had on Friday night? Remember the weather that we had on Friday? I mean, the wind and everything else. It was pretty bad. So I have a little pre-record I did with Cormac. So I'm going to play that at the end of the show. And Cormac will tell you and give you some information about the Youth Suicide Prevention Ireland, which we made a donation to Circle of White Light listeners who send in donations and to the Pay It Forward as well. That's where the donation went to. And for the December donations, going to be going to the homeless. We're going to be working with Linda and her team as well. And as I always say, folks, it's your donation. You know, all we're doing is passing the money on. We can't donate if we don't get any donations in from yourselves to help the groups that we're helping. So a big thank you to everybody who does donate to Circle of White Light and to the Pay It Forward. If you want to pop over to the website and have a look at the, click on the menu option, Pay It Forward, you'll see a whole list of all the charities that we've donated to and where the money went to. And they're all different types and individuals and everything else. So all the information is there. So if you want to check that out. So big thank you for people who donate. Okay, now we're going to get our guest on. Pat Green. Now, Pat is the leader of the DDI party. And Pat is well known as the leader of the DDI party in Ireland. DDI want to bring back direct democracy process and recall, which would enable the Irish people to call referendums and to sack politicians that do not do their job. Wouldn't that be fantastic? There is another side to Pat, and that is his interest in alternative healthcare. I will be talking to Pat about his knowledge and experience in this area, along with talking about COVID and what is currently taking place. Good evening, Pat. How are you?
Good evening, Alan. Good evening, everybody.
Thanks for coming on.
And you're welcome. It's great to be on, and it's a privilege and a pleasure.
Pat, thanks for coming on the show. Much appreciated. It's been a long time since I did a show with you. I think, as I mentioned earlier on, I think the last time I spoke to you on a show was probably around May 2018, which is a long time. And this is your first time on Circle of White Light Radio. So, you know, thanks for coming on. I suppose we better find out what the story is with DDI. And for people who, because there's new people who've woken up now, who probably have never heard of DDI, and what do they mean by direct democracy and recall, and what's going on with that? So for new people who don't know about DDI and what your policies are, because we had a quick chat before we went live, and the politicians are tainted. You know, people kind of go, I'm not going to bother with politicians. I don't want to vote. I don't want to go down there. They all feather their own nest, and they don't care about the people and everything else. And of course, you're going in as a government party, and people might have a certain attitude, but they have to remember that your party is going to be different, because the policies you offer is you're giving the power back to the people, which we don't have. So do you want to tell us a bit about DDI and what's how it came about and what the current status is with it?
Well, DDI started out a long time ago when I joined it. It was just a movement of people meeting once a month, trying to progress the numbers. And it was a slow process, but when people understood what direct democracy can achieve and how it operates, especially in Switzerland. Mind you, Taiwan has a very, very good system I looked at recently. But when they see what can be done with it and the control they have over their politicians, they suddenly realize, crikey, this is the actual solution to it all. And it is a solution-based political party. It's not, selling the same old, same old. It's not trying to rehash or reinvent the wheel. The movement then grew into the party when Ben Gilroy was there at the time. And being a young, fledgling party, made mistakes. There was errors in things being done, and we could have done better. Like even today, we could be doing better. But it's a very, very hard slog. If people think that they will start up a political party because they don't like what's going on here today, and vis-a-vis the COVID-19 or any other issue for that matter, it's not that easy. Mindset of people in this country or in any country has to be changed. And in doing that, it's extremely, extremely hard slog. And what happens is that you get to a stage where people get tired of trying to move these people along and they just drop out of the race. Mm. So with all the fledgling parties over the years, and the only two parties I can come across were back in the 1940s and one in 1951 or 52 started up from scratch. Clan of Fublucthe, whom my grandfather was actually involved with, they started up in the 40s and they got two or three, maybe four people into local authorities, a couple of TDs as well, especially down in Roscommon way. And what happened there was the Roscommon people decided to break away from Clan of Fublucthe and started up their own party, a name I can't remember. But then they dissolved that party and went in with Fianna Fáil. So, the history of setting up parties in this country is not a great one. And it's not that people don't want to. It's just that the system is weighted against you. It's just, that's it. And that's it in a nutshell. The other thing is that people tend to go into a political party with vigor and strength and energy, and then suddenly realize they're up against this monolith. Mm. And then they go, we're in it for the long haul. And then it's the impact on your family after that, because you have to get out there. You have to have the meetings. Like, for instance, here tonight is time taken away from family. Mm. For a lot of people. But if we don't do this, if we don't do this hard slog, there will never be change. The direct democracy, you were asking, what is it? And what do you compare it to? We were always comparing it to the Swiss model. Now, at the moment, we live in what's called a representative democracy. And if you break that word down, it's represent. So we live in a representative democracy. In other words, we put forward an individual from our group, whatever group we are. And that individual relays our thoughts and our aspirations to a larger group who then organize civil service to provide us with what it is we need. And that system has been turned on its head so that when we elect a representative, it doesn't represent us. He represents a party. And the party's manifesto is what you voted for. And people don't realize that. So when you see Mary Murphy, wherever she is, and she's the Fine Gael party, well, you didn't vote for Mary Murphy to represent you. You voted for the manifesto of the Fine Gael party to represent you. They cannot represent you in the Dáil. They can only represent you at the table in the head office of Fine Gael. Same goes for Fianna Fáil, Sinn Féin, Labour, the whole lot of them.
And plus, we have to mention that there is a party whip system there as well. And we have to talk about George Lee. Obviously, George Lee worked for RTE. He went and joined the Fine Gael party. When he went in there and he realised that it was institutionalised, he lasted for 9 months and then he left and realised that you can't do anything. And we had a quick chat before we went live, and I relate politics to the corporate world, where you're told a rope, do what you're told, or if you're not playing ball, you get kicked out, or you get, there's a scandal or something said or whatever. So the party whip controls the politicians, and they're told how to vote for the benefit of the party, because it's all got to do with the survival of the party. And and they are happy throwing out or losing one or two people. They've been thrown to the wolves for the survival of the party. They don't mind doing that.
It's not even that they don't mind doing it. It's they're institutionalized at an early stage in their career, and it is a career. They go into the county councils, and that's their training ground. That's where they're trained what to do, how to do it, and how to do what they're told. The party whip operates at the county councils as well. Actually, there's even a more insidious rot in democracy, and that's a pact. Every county council works in a pact. Fine Gael, Sinn Féin, Fianna Fáil will work together, and they won't cross each other. And they have a system whereby they share power and they share authority with each other. And it's not conducive to proper democracy. In other words, if I send someone from a particular party in to represent my views, but they're in a pact with the other parties, and then the other party's views are stronger, well, then I'm not represented, I mean. So that's at that end. But the party whip system is what turned our representative democracy upside down. It turned it into a dictatorship. Because a small cabal, nice little word that, of ministers sit in a room. They decide what's going to happen and then tell the TDs what's going to happen and how they're going to vote through the party whip system. And we're not consulted.
Yes.
Just nobody wants us to know what's going on, and they don't want us telling them what to do. And that is primarily down to the party whip system. That's why in Direct Democracy Ireland, we don't have a party whip. Now, journalists just can't get their head around it. Yeah, but how do you keep people in order? So we don't have to keep people in order. If they have a different view, so be it. That's their view. If their view rises to the top of people's agenda, that's fine. If we don't like their view, that's fine also. Doesn't mean we have to throw them out of the party. It doesn't mean that we have to chastise them or sanction them in some way, which is what happens in the existing system. It's just we can entertain another person's idea.
But this all goes back to what I've said before. It doesn't matter whether you have 100 people working for a company or 100,000 people. If there's a board of directors, the board of directors will dictate what's going to be happening in the company, regardless of the staff members. And it'll be all compartmentalized, and it's a hierarchical, and it's a need-to-know basis. And the information is fed down from the boardroom to all the middle management and everything else. Politics is a corporate company. I mean, we won't get into that, but it is a corporate company.
It has become a corporate company, primarily because in 1937, De Valera, with the help of Cosgrove, removed a section, Section 48, Article 48 of the 1922 Constitution. Now, I'm not going to get into people arguments of people saying it's not a constitution or this, that, the other. For the purposes of the conversation, we'll use the word constitution.
Exactly.
The 1922 Constitution had Article 48 in it, which gave us direct democracy. We had to go out and collect, I think it was 70,000 signatures across various counties. In other words, you couldn't hobhatch on O'Connell Street and just, sign there.
Yeah.
So you got a proper representation across, I think it was a minimum of 15 counties, and there's a percentage in each county that you had to acquire in a given time frame. And that is direct democracy. And that was removed by Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. And what we're effectively trying to do is bring in a more updated version of that, but not just for referenda on the constitution, but for referenda at local authority level. Here in Drogheda, there's planning permission going in seemingly endless amounts of it. Five, six story buildings and seven story blocks of apartments where all the housing around them, some one particular place, are bungalows. So suddenly you've got this massive tower sitting in the nested into in the middle of a housing estate full of bungalows. There goes your privacy. There goes your skyline, everything. Nobody was consulted. Now, that particular one has been withdrawn, but I can imagine it will come back from six stories to four stories, and they'll be told you're getting it this time, which is not good enough. The people are not being consulted. On the other side of town, there's another development, six, seven stories high, massive blocks of apartments, which is Agenda 21, Rackham and Stackham. I put them into cities and towns. The difficulty is that we have no say. Once we vote at an election, we're told, go back to sleep, stay away from us, we'll call you out again another 4 or 5 years when we need your tick again. Whereas with the Article 48 and direct democracy, you can call a referendum at any time. You can decide to go down to the local county council offices or any civil service office, you know, government office, and you get a starter pack. And that is a legal document and a legal certificates. And you must collect those signatures within a given time frame and a given number of signatures. For instance, County Louth, with its population, all you should really need is about 700 signatures in a six-month period. Now, that's very hard to do. Try and get two people to agree with you, let alone 700. But it can't be made too easy. And it can't be made too difficult either, as it has in Sweden. They've brought in direct democracy, but the numbers required for to get across the line are just astronomical. And that once you have that ability, county councillors will second guess trying to take your power away, because within a few months you can have them fired. That's recall.
Yeah.
Now recall is a little bit more tricky, but can be done. And again, we had that in 22 as well, but it was taken away by Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. Wonder why. And with recall, if you've got a guy who's in power and is abusing it, you may not need total proof, but you might need some sort of proof. And you go and say, right, that's it, you're out. They have that in Britain as it stands. But it's only under very, very limited circumstances. It was activated, I think, there about 2 years ago. But again, if we don't have the ability to slap these people on the wrist during their term in office, they have full and unbridled power. And the old saying that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely is definitely evident in this country. So the vision I would have is that if Direct Democracy Ireland or any other organization that has direct democracy got into power tomorrow, that direct democracy would not be fully implemented for at least 15 years. Now, a lot of people look at me and go, ah, what? Why don't you give it to me straight away? It's too dangerous in the wrong hands. And that is one of the things that have been levied at me over the years, that how could you give these people, how can you give citizens the right to change the constitution? Well, for instance, I don't think any citizen should have the right to change the constitution. Only nationals should have the right to change the constitution, because it belongs to nationals. That's where the constitution resides. It's an agreement between Irish families. It's not an agreement between Irish families and, say, Polish families.
Yeah.
Latvian families or Nigerian families or South African families or American or Canadian. It's between Irish people, and only Irish nationals should be allowed to vote on it. Irish citizens, completely different thing altogether. A citizen is just a member of a group, of a club. It's like the Royal Dublin Society, the RDS in Dublin. Once you request to be a member of that society, you effectively become a citizen of that society, and once you're in their grounds, you're subject to their rules and regulations, which are acts and statutes, and that is what a citizen is. It's at the bottom of the pile and must agree and obey everything. A national, on the other side, is above the state and is above the courts. That doesn't mean they evade the courts. If they're above them, the courts must serve them and their needs. Mm. So with direct democracy and with the power residing properly within the people, the sovereignty resides with the people. What the state does is more focused on what the people's needs are, not what corporations need, what the people need. And yeah, that's why it's a solution-based system, because we solve our own problems. We don't have politicians, we don't have ministers dictating to us, creating problems. They have created massive problems.
It's going to be a big hill to climb, because the people are very wary of politicians, first and foremost. I mean, when I say that, on one hand I'm saying that, on the other hand, people keep voting these people in. I was going to say a word there, but I won't. But they keep voting them in, and as you say, it's the parish pump. You know, they're good at turning up in the hospital, or if there's a funeral and they go, oh, look, I want to get the pothole fixed, and they get the pothole fixed, and then, sure, I'll give you me vote, you know. And time and time again, every 4 or 5 years, or 5 years when the elections come around, people do the same thing, and there's no critical thinking. There's no going, hang on a minute, this is what's happening in Ireland, and the amount of, I mean, we have more suicides in Ireland now than we do have from COVID deaths, inverted commas. And, you know, the amount of homeless that's out there, over 10,000, I think, is the number, is unbelievable. And yet, people are just letting these people carry on in government and voting them in and saying, well, I probably won't do Fianna Fáil this time, I'll do Fianna Gael, not realising that they're the both sides of the same cheek. You know, saying both cheeks are the same.
Squeeze a fart between, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, at the end of the day, and it's this lack of thinking. People just don't seem to want to think. Just let them go on and do it. That's their job. No, they're destroying the country, and they will destroy you and your family. The fact that you might be okay at the moment, but you won't be okay down the road if you let them carry on doing what they're doing. And they will carry on doing what you're doing if you don't, if it's not changed or it's not stopped, or another party comes in to challenge them. But, you know, the whole kind of psychology of a part to try and wake people up, you know, even if direct democracy got a massive funding and you came out with glitz and glamour and said, we're DDI and here we are and we're ready to go.
No, wouldn't get in.
Just trying to convince the people. To, you know, because they go, oh, well.
If I can come in there,
yeah,
Alan.
Go ahead.
I just looked in the chat room there. They're talking about, was it a 14-story block of apartments?
In Lucan. Lucan, yeah. 20-story in Lucan, yeah.
20-story, yeah. Did you see that there now? 20-story in Lucan. And it's the same here in Drogheda with the 16 or the 6-story and 7-story blocks of apartments. And the Irish people, it's not for our society. We don't live like living in these things. Temporarily, yes, as students or as, you know, starting off in a job where you need somewhere to stay in an apartment for a couple of years, but not as for families. Apart from the regulations in this country, meaning that they are actually dog boxes. Whereas in Germany or in France, when you get an apartment, it's a equivalent to a two-story semi-detached on the flat. That's the size of the apartments. Whereas here, they are just literally dog boxes. Now, I lost my train of thought. The thing you were saying there about, sorry, Alan, just tell me what you were saying there a second ago. I just lost my train of thought on that because I was so angry at that's what it is. The blocks of apartments, when these things go up, especially here in Drogheda, you get a lot of people who are suddenly woken out of their sleep. They're in this kind of daze that bring them from year to year. Oh, they've made their tick, a couple of years, March last or February, March, they made their little tick, and that's it, they all go back to sleep. And then something happens on their doorstep, and then they start questioning what's going on, when they should have started questioning before they made their tick. But that point in their life, that point in time, is what's classed as what's called an Overton window. There's other descriptions of it, but this particular description is the one I hang on. Overton was a guy who first described it. And when society is basically happy in their nappy. They're happy out. They're being looked after. They've no cares really in the world. There's a few bothers here and there, but no major cares. They just sit there, and if you want to start discussing something like a block of apartments going in, they just don't want to know. But the reason is that when everybody is happy, the amount of space in their mind that's available for having different arguments or for having arguments about progressing things in a different way is very, very narrow. So the window is very narrow. They don't want to discuss anything out of the ordinary. But when it's shook with these blocks of apartments going in, suddenly they're open to having new ideas brought in. And that's the Overton window is starting to open up. Mm. And what we need to do is the hard slug. And we need to be at these meetings explaining how direct democracy would save them from this sort of catastrophe. And for them, it's a catastrophe. For everybody else, it's, oh, there's a block of apartments going up over there. And the same in Lucan. Oh, there's a block of apartments going up in Lucan. Oh, yeah. It's not affecting Palmerstown. It's not affecting Kilmeacanog. It's not affecting Galway. So they don't care. So their Overton windows are narrow. They don't have any issues happening in their locality. But we have to wait until an issue does happen in their locality that does wake them up to having new ideas. Now, they'll go down to the local authority, they'll have their meetings. And the usual way the meetings take place is, say you could have 300 or 400 in the meeting. That'd be quite a large one. And you'll have the first 2.5 hours of a 3-hour meeting with people standing up, complaining about how they feel. Mm. I feel terrible. This is going to take this from me. This is going to do that to me. And they're moaning. No logic involved. They're just moaning. The last 20 minutes of the meeting is where politicians are standing or sitting up at the top table and they're saying, oh, I know how you feel. I know this is a disaster. I know that, you know, the pain you're going through. I have a cousin down in Galway and it happened to her, and they may never have had a cousin in Galway at all, but they'll say all of these things and they've rounded off by saying, I know how you feel and I'm your man. I'll get it sorted for you. I'll get this stopped. I'll represent you and blah, blah, and they'll get voted for. But it's the likes of DDI go to that meeting. We're shouted down. We're not allowed to talk and what have you. So what we have to do is circumvent even that and go directly door to door. This is the hard slug. And explain to each individual at the door that this is what direct democracy can do. And this direct democracy would stop this in its tracks. If nothing else, you wouldn't even have to go out and get a referendum on it, because the politicians know it would have failed. They know, and they wouldn't have put it forward in the first place.
Mm. I know,
so
but
that's what we need to do. We need to get on the ground, and that's where Direct Democracy Ireland and other parties need to regroup, organise with each other at least, at the very least, and feet on the ground and do votes. Have a vote out in the community. I've made up voting cards similar to referendum voting cards. Do you want this particular thing to go ahead? Yes or no? And have a vote.
Yeah.
And present the numbers to the people and present it to everyone else and show how this thing could be stopped.
I think you have to explain to them what direct democracy is and what recall is, because a lot of people don't understand it. And when you say to them, well, it was actually in our original constitution, I mean, they really don't know the history. They don't know the constitution. And then sometimes they'll just make up an excuse. Actually, how is that going to change it? And then the other thing they normally argue is, you know, as Ben says about the having the pink shoes in County Meath, you know, I'm sure you'd be having a referendum every 5 minutes. No, you won't be having a referendum every 5 minutes. You could actually, if there's referendums that need to be done, then you could arrange for one, maybe once a quarter or maybe once every 6 months to actually go in and vote on the things that need to be voted on, depending on whether it affects the people in Meath or Cavan or Louth or whatever. And it can be structured and organised. I know you're idea. I know you're saying about, you know, don't do it for 15 years because obviously it could be abused, and I agree.
It's a re-education.
Yeah.
It sounds condescending, but unfortunately people don't realize what's happening, and they don't really know how to critically analyze what's going on around them. And that needs to start in schools more than anywhere else. And then from there, you show them how it works at a local level.
Mm.
And the least amount of damage can be done in the first 5 to 10 years. And then at the 15th year, then you have it at national level. So if there's a road going down a particular way, or if there's a major infrastructural issue that needs to be done, it can be pushed by the people, and the state will just have to do what they're told.
Well, I just think that we know we have to change the education system anyway, because the what the students are learning is not true history, as we know. So that all has to be changed. I'm going to go over to some of the questions that's on the... I know you're on the chat room there, Pat, as well.
I haven't been looking.
Oh, okay, yeah. I'll call them out there. Question for Pat. No name wants to know there. I would favour local democracy via Breherin law. Parliamentary democracy is centralised power. We must get back to natural law at local levels with instant accountability. Can you ask him, is he in favour of Breherin law system?
Well, yes and no. I'm not trying to hedge my bets here. I'm not trying to be a politician as such. The Breherin law, first and foremost... To go back to that, that would be a major re-educational system, or re-education of the people, to go back to that. The size of the population we have today also has its own issues. The Breton law could run along in conjunction over time frame and build up slowly. I like the idea of Breton law. I think it could be reintroduced into the court system here to do that. But for the complexities of such a very, very large population, and our population is not particularly large by international standards, I think the centralized system, but with direct democracy, it's not centralized. It brings democracy right down to the local level, and it's not even a county council level. Like the county councils today are an amalgamation of the smaller borough councils. Like in Drogheda, we had Drogheda Borough Council, with South Drogheda Council, South Louth, Mid Louth, and North Louth and Cooley. So it was broken up quite well. And with direct democracy, you go back down to that. But the democracy aspect of it is not necessarily the law side of it. They're two separate issues. Now, they do go hand in hand. The Breton law is more of a natural law, and I'm trying to remember the word I was looking for. It's restorative justice. Now, I'm all in favour of restorative justice. I have no time for the existing system of punitive justice that we have today, where everything is penalties, 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 penalties. It gets us nowhere. The prisons just get bigger. They're looking to build more of them. They're cramming them in. And it's all based on finance. It's all based on pulling money in. The people who are robbed are still robbed. The people who are injured are still injured. Insurance might replace them, the goods, but there's no real justice done. The individual serves time in a prison. That's just penalties. That's nothing. It's a pain in the bloody arse. There are some people, sorry for the language, there are some people who need to be isolated from the rest of society. Mm. And even in Breton law, that was noted as well. But they're few and far between relative to the size of the prison population that's there today.
Mm. Well, I think most of the politicians need to be isolated from society, to be honest with you. But that's just my opinion. Okay.
Alan, just not to skirt around it, the Breton law system, yes, but a more modern version of it would be restorative justice, and that's what I'd be in favour of more so.
That's okay, no problem at all. Right, okay, question from Tash, and she wants to know, why do we have pencils to mark our ballot papers? Our elections have been rigged for years. Breton law, the fairest in the world.
It's, again, the Breton law has its limits, like all all politics or all ways of ruling society, not ruling over society, but ruling society. The whole idea of a society is that the rules are implied. The question, sorry, run that question again. Where is it again?
It was the pencils to mark the ballot.
Oh, yeah, the pencils. You can use a pen. The idea of pencils, people put a lot of weight on them, saying that, oh, it's easy to rub them out. I've been through elections. I've seen what goes on. They don't use such a simple – that's a very cumbersome, difficult process, is the rubbers will end up – you'll see where the marks were rubbed out. The idea of the pencils is that they're put into storage for 5 years, and the graphite in the pencils doesn't go off, and they can be sharpened. Mm. Whereas pens, if you put them into storage for 5 years, the ink can dry up, it can harden. You can get air bubbles in it and all sorts of other issues. That's the reason, and it's a bona fide reason for not using pens. You can bring a pen in and mark with a pen. It's not illegal, and it doesn't spoil your ballot. I've seen plenty of ballot papers in pen, the odd one in marker, the narrow markers, not the big, thick ones. Mm. And the adjudicators have had no issues with them whatsoever. So I think there's too much weight put on the pencils. What they do is they will stuff the ballots, or as they did in our situation in County Louth, they found a box within the last half hour. Now, we were too wet behind the ears to call for a whole full recount, and we should have. But we were being congratulated on running a fantastic campaign here in Drogheda, and Ronan lost out by 35 votes.
And
that's what they do. They don't go for the difficult. It's much easier for them just to find a box or stuff a box, and that's what they'll do.
I am very concerned. I mean, I'm so concerned about the voting in Ireland that I actually deregistered. I don't vote, and I can't vote because I deregistered, because there has been... I've seen enough footage and spoken to people who've seen things firsthand for me to be concerned that the voting system is not legit. Now, I'm saying that's just my own opinion, based on, you know, stuff, you know, video I've seen and individuals who've seen stuff firsthand. So it's secondhand to me what they've seen it firsthand, and that's just my opinion on the whole voting system. So I'm very concerned now, obviously, with the whole Dominion voting servers that we've heard about America and what's been going on there. Then you have to scratch your head and go, hang on a minute, what are we doing regarding voting? I know we're not using computer systems yet, but, you know, we did have computer systems there a while ago. They spent something like 50 or 60 million on the voting machines and then sold them off for something like 600,000. Yeah, what a waste!
No, it
of
wasn't
taxpayers.
Even 600,000.
It's probably even less than that. Yeah, no. What a waste of taxpayers' money.
Well, we still haven't finished there, because a lot of the buildings that were built by civil servants, I might ask, when they saw there was no, they had to be specially dehumidifier, the atmosphere controlled storage facilities for them, and they were in 30-year contracts. Wow. And we either had to buy them out at full cost or just rent empty buildings.
See, this is the problem with, because they're spending air money. So they don't care. It's not their money. So they just throw money at a problem or an issue, or when they're spending money, like the overrun hospital, children's hospital, God knows how much money that's going to cost the taxpayer. And we all have to pay that back. But as long as they're getting their big salary and they're on their big pension, I mean, it's blatant. It has to be blatantly obvious to so many people that our system is fundamentally flawed in so many ways. But yet, you know, people still vote for these people. I don't get it. I don't get their logic, their thinking, you know. And it's not a case. I mean, we spoke earlier before the show. We said, well, okay, let's look at the scenario, especially with the virus. Okay, so people are in fear. That means their prefrontal cortex will close down, because that's the logical part of your mind that would
lobotomized.
That'll be lobotomized. So, so they're in fear, so they can't think logically. Okay, that's fine, and that applies to fear. But you're not in fear about voting for parties. If you just look at what's going on in the actual country and the suicides and the homelessness and all that, surely you have to say, well, this is not right. There's something going on. But then again, there are the other side of, we all know about the I'm OK Jacks. And, NIMBYs. That's what Jerry Ryan called them on the radio when he was alive, NIMBYs. Not in my backyard.
Mm-hmm. And I met one the other day in a queue waiting to be served in the shop. And these sort of individuals they make up the majority of the population, the voting population. I would deregister for other reasons, but the idea of deregistering for me, in my own personal view on it, because of the corruption, I wouldn't deregister on that basis, but I certainly would deregister if I want to go up against the state in court. The whole problem of where we're going with democracy and what we're going to do with it and how we get around these ideas that people see what's going on but continue to vote. And it's like Christmas cards. People are fed up writing them, but they keep writing them. And then when they write them, others write them back, and then they go, it's a vicious circle. The biggest problem we have, apart from our politicians, is that we do not have a functioning journalistic grouping.
Yeah.
The journalists have a special place in all societies to keep questioning and keep an eye on what is happening in the state. Now, with direct democracy, we can circumvent the journalists because each individual can bring to the attention of everybody around him an issue that's going on. And that is the beauty of that, going back to direct democracy. But the journalists in Ireland have let us down dramatically. They would get grade A plus plus in their exams for being government lackeys.
Exactly. And a lot of the media is funded now by the government, apparently. That's the rumour, because their numbers are down. People are not buying the rags anymore. And so they've been funded with adverts and stuff from the government. So it's in their interest now to tow the rope.
Yeah, the way that's done is they don't get funded. But for argument's sake, if I wanted to take out a full page ad in the Irish Times, now I am not saying this is actually happening in the Irish Times. I'm saying this is what can happen. If I could be charged, say, €20,000 for a full-page ad in the Irish Times for one day, and I tell you it's a lot more than that, the government would pay somewhere in the region of $150,000 for the same ad, where I would pay $20,000 or you would pay $20,000. That's how they do it. That is a legitimate transaction, but is it subsidizing the likes of these newspapers in that manner? Now, I know that happens. The other is that with the COVID situation, there is a list out there already of the level of funding given to local radio stations and media outlets to push forward the HSE narrative. The LMFM got €95,000 in the second tranche. I don't know how much they've got since, but €95,000 is going to shut them up, and the likes of us who want to put in a different narrative are blocked out.
Yeah.
And this is what they're doing. They're buying their silence. And that is an abomination. Mm. How in God's name can you have a functioning society when the people who are supposed to be keeping a check on the politicians are paid off?
Yeah. Exactly, and controlled, and of course, if you don't toe the rope with the narrative, then obviously there are, maybe the broadcasting license would be come under scrutiny, maybe.
There's a situation that arose from a publication that is friendly to DDI. And we put together a press release to question the narrative, to question what was happening, the idea of, counting cases, explaining that, as we all know, the PCR test is not a diagnostic test. Mm. Talking about all of this, and he said, Pat, he said, I'm after getting €20,000 from HSE. I have a family to feed. And I said to him, that's all right. I understand. That's what has happened in this country, this world. And see, earlier on, I think you alluded to the fact that none of this is, none of solving society's issues are going to be easy, because it's also intertwined.
Mm.
But there's one thread that runs through it all, and that's finance.
Mm.
The only finance available to big tech and big companies and big pharma is taxes. That's all that's left.
Mm.
And stripping your money, your savings out through taxation and getting the state to pay them for services rendered.
Mm.
And we are left out of the loop on that.
Yeah.
So we're hung out to dry by the journalists. We're hung out to dry by the state. And we're hung out to dry by practically everybody who just wants their hands in our pockets. And we are powerless to do anything about it.
Well, you know, I would say at the moment.
At the moment, yeah. That's at the moment. I was just saying that, going to say that, that you have all the lads in the courts fighting to hold on to their dwellings. And there's only one word needed in court, but not one judge in this entire country will use that word, dwelling.
Exactly.
That's
yeah.
it. Simple word, not one word court will do it. And if you try to use the word dwelling, they'll put you in jail.
Mm.
Contempt. And well, contempt is, you know, and if a judge finds you in contempt, according to the European Court, there has to be another court case to decide if that judge actually found you in contempt properly. They're not allowed to judge that you are in contempt, or sorry, accuse you of contempt and then judge you to be in contempt. You can't do it.
I know. Well, they do it because there's three lads in Mountjoy prison at the moment.
But that is how corrupt the system has become. It's primarily because a journalist will go into that same court and kowtow and lick the backsides of the judges.
Yeah.
And this is where we're failing.
It's just a cesspit of corruption that needs to be changed. I'm going to go off to, just watching the time there, Pat, I'm just going to go off to questions there. Question from Bluebell. The problem with Helen McAtee, it's who is behind pushing the same agenda all the time, because she hasn't got the intelligence to be doing any of this. They are controlled puppets. I mean, let's be honest, they are.
I was just reading a book that was written, I think, firstly in 1953. I was trying to pick out some parts from it. And it's called The Power Elite by C. Wright Mills. You can get it on PDF free of charge. And the politicians that we have, because we've no control over them, others will control them. And they let it happen because it's financially beneficial.
Yeah.
The power elite, we all talk about the elites as if they're some homogenous group who think together, who act together, who are always there in the background. And this guy, C. Wright Mills, was saying, and I think you agree with him, that the power elites are there in the background. They don't bother with the day-to-day running of the state until their particular area of expertise and business is threatened by the people. Then they act together in a cohesive unit. So you might have the beef sector or the farming sector. If there's a group of people, the power elites in Europe, who feel threatened by what the Irish government want to bring in, suddenly the Department of Agriculture will get a phone call from a particular individual in the EU and say, no, you can't do that.
Mm.
Oh, by the way, if you spin it this way, there's a few bob in it for you.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying that happens, but I'm saying because we have no power, that can happen. But if we have the power, it can't happen.
Well, I interviewed Cathy Sinnott, and she was an MEP. And at the time, she was in Europe regarding the Lisbon Treaty. And she said that, I mean, they were fighting against the Lisbon Treaty because of what took place. They asked us the first time, we said no. And he obviously said, oh, no, no, you got the wrong answer. The yes is what you're looking for. And she said that she knew that they wanted yes, and they weren't going to accept anything else unless it was a yes. And regardless of what they said, it was irrelevant. They knew that they wanted yes. And this is the problem with the power from Europe. Now, there's an argument on both sides, because I did speak to Ben about this one time, and we were saying, well, we should erect it and get out of Ireland, but or get out of Europe, sorry. But the what Ben said was, we still have European laws, which is going to be beneficial to Ireland, because if we let Ireland step away from Europe, then as bad as a cesspit as it is at the moment, it'll get 10 times worse.
Yeah, that's why Nigel Farage, now we have no contact, EDI have no contact with Nigel Farage, and we've no alignments with him or anything like that. That is a caveat, unfortunately, we have to put in place, but it's true. Now, in the past, I think Ben and someone else spoke to Nigel Farage at a different meeting about direct democracy, and it was a revelation to him. How well it works. And he started up a direct democracy group within the EU. Now it's foundering because the British exit. But the difficulty with the EU is, as you just described, is a top-down system. And we don't know actually who's controlling it. But if we bring direct democracy right across Europe at a federal level, and we are in a federal Europe, whether we like it or not, well then, I've no problems with Europe if it's a democratically run system and it responds to the needs of the people. Fine. And there's demarcation. It doesn't mean the French overall rule the Irish and or vice versa for that matter. It is that when our needs are met locally, you cannot impose other rules on top of that that upset our needs.
Yeah.
So the power remains at the bottom, locally, in each parish. And the power at the top is diminished dramatically. In Switzerland, the government is extremely small. The number of ministers is very small. And they're not paid very well either. I would suggest that they should be paid a bit more than they are being paid. But the point I'm getting at is they have very little power in the ministerialships in Switzerland relative to other nations.
Well, industrial wage, I totally agree. The trouble is with the Irish politicians, they're paid too much, as far as I'm concerned. They're in there to do a job, and they can be paid. I'm not saying they have to be paid poorly, but I think they're just overpaid for what they do.
But you see, that goes back to they decide. Mm. We've no discussion about it. They decide.
Yeah.
Which again, like everything that you say or any issue or problem that arises in this state, be it Irish water, be it the banks, be it evictions, all of that can be discussed at local level and sorted out within 6 months to 18 months. And that's the end of the story. And the courts can do sweet feck all about it because the people have decided. That's what the beauty of direct democracy. It solves literally all of our issues. It has its drawbacks, but go ahead, sorry.
Maybe we should be looking at, there's a couple of questions I want to get in there. We should look at it from on a county basis. Maybe just an idea that, we have our courts, or we have a voting system on a per county basis, and you have to be registered. You live in the county to actually vote on whatever needs to be done. I don't know. I mean, brainstorming sessions are always good. I've been in so many in the corporate world where you look and see what's the best solution for it all, regardless of what the current system is. Find a way that works for the people. As the old saying is, the Native American saying is, if it's not good for everybody, it's not good. Now, obviously, I do understand that we are in a republic and, democracy itself, 51% telling 49% what to do, doesn't work. It's kind of mob rule. So we'd have to look at the Republic solution, which is, I think, 75% of the people, which is...
Even 67% would be a better consensus. The Swiss system is a consensus model.
Yeah.
And that is the whole reason for it, is that they've had, this German side of it, the French... the Italians, the Swiss themselves, and these are different nations, different languages, and they have to get on with each other. Otherwise, they're constantly fighting. So they set up this system of direct democracy 200 years ago and found it works very, very well.
Yeah, that's what we need to do. Just getting on the questions there. Liam on the chat room said, why do we store the ballot boxes in Garda stations overnight after an election? The ballot boxes are out of sight until counting starts next day. Yeah, quite convenient that, Liam, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Mm. We have argued, and I see a question further down from Liam. We have argued time and time again that there should be no storage of boxes. They should be brought straight to a count, and the count should start straight away.
Mm. Totally.
It's count centre. Simple as that. Mm. There should be none of this. Like, for justice to be done, it must be seen to be done. And for democracy to work, it must seem to be actually battened down, no chances for any skullduggery, similar to what's going on in the United States at the moment. And the only way you can do that is knock on the head any opportunity for a box to be found,
yeah,
or for boxes to be stuffed. And if you have a time frame that is basically these boxes are under the Gardaí, crying out loud, look what happened here in Louth, where they were investigating what was going on with the drug lords over here. And the entire file gathered by the Gardaí landed on the lap of one of the drug lords. Now, that can only have come from the Gard.
Yeah.
Now, you have that level of corruption going on in Gardaí, and this is not an isolated case, I might add. If you have that level of corruption going on and they're put in charge of the ballot boxes, hello?
Yeah. it's unbelievable. And, you know, I don't know how we're going to sort this mess out. I do want to touch base with you regarding COVID, obviously, because that's one of the topics that we'll have to, that's happening today. And obviously people have issues with that. And I know you have a background in health as well, so you obviously have an interest in that. What's your take on what's happening with COVID and how things are being managed by the government at the moment?
Where do you start? Mm. The whole thing was based on fear. The state listened to experts, and experts, as my mother always said, was a group of people who read books that no one else read. It doesn't mean that they're particularly good at thinking. They just read books. But unfortunately, the parish pump politics doesn't exactly bring the brightest to the top. So they went on experts' views based on a computer model that was completely useless, but has taken this length of time to be seen to be useless. They based their ideas on fear. Their fear was genuine in theirs. It was their story. It was their truth. But they were wrong. They then put actually infected people into old folks' homes or care homes where no infections were in the first place. There was just no infections there. And suddenly they put a rotten apple in to a barrel full of good apples. And everybody knows what happens then. The vast bulk of deaths came from the care homes. Now, the care homes, again, the treatment in care homes, as I found out by talking to nurses in three different care homes in three different jurisdictions. That's Scotland, north of Ireland, and here. And the care, the drugs given was morphine. They weren't given anything to help their immune system combat the infection. Mm. Nothing was done in those lines. So the government reacted out of fear, which means the frontal the lobotomy is gone anyway, so not thinking that straight. They don't have the skill sets to think straight. And the only people they can ask for advice are more people who drink from the same well of information within the health system. They will only talk to doctors, medics, trained within the existing system. They will not talk to people outside of that who are in alternative medicine, who have different ways of looking at things. So they are hamstrung by themselves. They require, they hear some experts speak, then they go to another expert, but both experts have read from the same book. Mm. So they're going to come up with the same situation.
Yeah.
Although there are very few like Dolores Cahill and others who are coming out and they are trying to do a rear guard action. They are fighting fires all over the place, but there's only a handful of them because the others are living in fear. They don't want to come out and say it. or if they're not living in fear, they just believe it wholeheartedly. But Dr. David Brownstein over in Michigan, he's an MD. There's four in the practice, four MDs. And they have been using a protocol, an antiviral protocol effectively, for years beforehand. And I think it started in with H1N1. His background is that his father got ill, and the mainstream medicine, which he's a part of, did nothing. And he found out afterwards that iodine would have kept his father alive. So he, the reason I got involved with, well, not involved, but I follow David Brownstein, and I've been following him for the best part of 10 years, is his use of iodine in curing a lot of illnesses and diseases. But he had this protocol that stopped COVID-19 in its tracks within 24 hours, and he was administering it in a car park. Wow. He had 110 patients. Three of them, I think, were hospitalized, but they came at a very late stage. But they recovered in hospital and maintained his protocols in the hospital. Everyone else around them was dying. Now, that was back in March, April, when David Brownstein came out. He used to do a morning Zoom call. It wasn't so much a Zoom call, but you could ask questions. It's similar to the radio station here. You could go online and ask questions directly to him.
Okay.
And he was threatened by his licensing authority that if he didn't come off Facebook, if he didn't stop what he was doing, his license would be taken from him.
See, this is what they do. This is whether, you know, this is why you want people to have a license, because you can be threatened then. And this is the whole game. And this
it's
is why
a control mechanism.
Exactly. And this is why the whole system has to change, because it's just ridiculous.
He's one of many, sorry, Jan. He's one of many who have different protocols across the world that are stopping COVID. The difficulty we have is that everything we hear from our peers around us who are pro the narrative, the first thing they'll go for is people are dying. People are dying, and how dare you say that doctors aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing? Mm. They will defend their belief system to the nth degree. And the difficulty that they have is that they do not see that the existing medical system can only treat symptoms.
Yeah.
It cannot do anything to help the immune system. Mm. It can only treat the symptoms of it.
Yeah.
Now, the just hang on a second. The only difficulty, the difficulty they have is that they're caught up in this trap of emotional outrage and belief in the doctors. Mm. But they won't, the doctors themselves won't go outside of what they're told to do.
Yeah, because they could lose the license.
Yes, and Alan Smith, if somebody wants to Google Mr. Smith IV Vitamin C New Zealand 60 Minutes, and that was a H1N1, which was 2008. And part of Brownstein's protocol, if you're available to be there, is that injections of vitamin C, which is intravenous vitamin C, and ozone. By the way, ozone is a disinfectant. So you know who was given out to for saying a disinfectant will kill it.
Yeah.
But it was ozone is what he was referring to, as far as I'm concerned. The whole difficulty is that they won't try these things. Alan Smith, their family found out about IV vitamin C just as their father was supposed going to be taken off life support. And the doctors there, specialists, laughed at them, told them basically to get out. If you want to go to the jungles, go to the jungles. And they had a robust conversation, apparently, with the doctor, who then decided to prescribe the IV vitamin C. Now, my imagination runs a little bit, but you can imagine the robust conversation went something like, Doc, yeah, we're four stories up. Yeah, can you fly? Yeah. Because that's the conversation I'd have.
Yeah.
Anyway, he recovered fully, completely. And he was supposed to be dead. He would have died had they taken him off the life support when they wanted to. That's 12 years ago. And nothing has been done on that. Mm. Absolutely nothing. My own experience is that and David Brown's experience and others in the alternative. Now, David Brown is not alternative by any means, but he's doing things that are not kosher with his community. Mm. He has stepped outside of the mark, but he's not doing anything that's going to kill anybody. But it's cheap, it's cheerful, and it can't be patented. There's the difficulty.
Yeah.
So when you go on to the other treatments, they're the same. They're cheap, cheerful, and off patent. Mm. And now this vaccine is coming out. So we have to get our heads around, or the people have to get their heads around, that a doctor who tells you what to do, you go to him for an opinion. An opinion is, I think you should do. Mm. It is not an order that you do it. The difficulty I have with the existing medical system is that when I go in and I want to get IV vitamin C, I have to go through that gatekeeper. Mm. And they are gatekeepers for the people who are in power, the pharmaceutical companies in this instance. So the gatekeeper says, I cannot get IV vitamin C. But if I go back to my sovereignty, which direct democracy gives you, it doesn't give you, it allows you to work with your sovereignty. It allows you to
exercise it.
That's the word I was looking for. Thank you. So I should be able to go into a hospital and say, I want IV vitamin C, 35 milligrams every 2 days because I have cancer. I actually don't even have to give you a reason why I want it. But I know that at 35 grams every other day, my chances of surviving that cancer are tenfold. Yeah. They say no. Who gave them the right to say no?
Well, don't all doctors have an oath?
That oath, no, they don't take it. We think they do. The oath is not there. It's gone a long, long time ago, believe it or not.
Right. Okay.
They just turn out to be doctors, and that's it. But then they do as they're told.
Well, I interviewed Dr. Lorraine Day on the show on OAM years ago, and she was an ex-trauma surgeon and a medical doctor. And she said on the show that doctors were only good for two things, writing prescriptions and removing body parts. That was her opinion, and she was a doctor.
Yeah, that's it. I have the same opinion.
Yeah.
My own experience is that when I treat people for illnesses or diseases, and the doctors are absolutely amazed at what's happening with these people, none of them pick up the phone and ask me, what did I do? They don't even ask the patient what they did. Mm. Yet they have seen, in their eyes, miraculous recoveries. In my eyes, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
The one comes to mind of a woman who had severe morning sickness. It's very prevalent. But she was at the point where she couldn't even keep water down. Now, I'm not advocating that everybody does this. That's the caveat, but it's something to think about. This individual, anyway, she was going to be hospitalized to be given certain drugs, and the reason you were hospitalized was they were extremely dangerous to both mother and child. Mm. Now, she got wind. She knew somebody who knew me, and I got a phone call. And I asked three questions. One of which was, at what point do you feel like vomiting? And she said, as soon as I get the smell of it. I said, right, okay, I'll think about it and I'll come back. But I knew what the story was there and then. And the next 20 minutes, half an hour, I spent pacing up and down, deciding whether I should get involved or not with a pregnancy at this stage, because if anything goes wrong, you know who's going to get home. Mm. She rang back after 20 minutes insisting that I give her an answer. So I told her to get a coffee enema bucket, but put chamomile tea in it. An enema bucket with chamomile tea. She took the enema on a Tuesday night and had breakfast Wednesday morning.
Wow.
Not one doctor asked her, what did she do? Mm. I knew from the conversation, the very brief 3-minute conversation, was her liver was completely blocked. It wasn't functioning. And she needed to unblock it. And there's only two ways you can do it. That I know, well, there's three ways, but the one I prefer is, if somebody is highly toxic, you use chamomile tea. If somebody is less toxic but can take it, take coffee enemas. Now, if somebody is very toxic, you start with chamomile tea for few days, two or three times a day, and then move on to the coffee. And then the coffee for as long as it takes to clear the liver. But that's an individualized approach. I'm only giving you a generalization, and I don't ask anyone to do it unless they have the information on how to do it. But the point I'm getting at is not one doctor rang up or talked to her and asked her, what did you do?
No, because they have this the arrogance of their medical training behind them, and for them to turn around and to be humble to ask you would be probably accepting defeat. You know that their tools or their methods or their drugs, didn't do the job or couldn't do the job.
It's not just that; is that if they know about it, they won't be able to tell anyone else because it's not in their book. The information is in their books, but it's not on their list of approved treatments.
Yeah, so they can't.
Which
do
is
it.
Controlled, so they can't do it. So that is one of the reasons. The only time a doctor, a specialist, asked what was done was in Germany. A man fell from a height. He was on an induced coma for 5 days. His wife found him in his own feces in 3 of those days because their hospitals are being run the same as ours, into the ground. Mm. Problem, reaction, solution, if anybody understands that one. But through a friend of a friend, came to my door, and I asked a few questions, and I understood what was going on. I told him what to do. He did it to a T. And within three, he was suicidal, by the way, with the pain. What it meant to say was he got an infection in his penis, in his urethra. And it was so painful, he was contemplating suicide.
Wow.
And that's not an overstatement. The pain was so excruciating. It was 2 to 3 weeks after he started getting the pain that he arrived at my door. And I had the phone call with him through an interpreter, explained what needed to be done. He did it to a T. And the doctor looked at him and said, within 2 weeks it had reversed. And he said, what did you do? He explained to him. He was just in disbelief because there were 17 other men in the same hospital in the same position.
Oh.
And the only treatment that they have available is an extremely strong antibiotic. And you're hospitalized while you're on the antibiotic. Mm. You're not incapacitated.
Yeah.
Is that these antibiotics are so strong, they can kill you.
No.
And that was all they had available to the other 17 men. The doctor, I don't know if he did it, but all what I said to the individual concerned was that he used to go off all sugars. And I mean everything. All he used to eat was vegetables and meat, nothing else. He used to drink water and nothing else.
Okay.
Because what had happened in my mind was, and it turned out to be right, the feces had gut bacteria and they got into his urinary tract. And they were eating him from the inside out. They were digesting him.
God.
So you can imagine the pain.
Oh, my God.
And what was happening was he had so much sugar in his diet, it was coming out in his urine, and he was feeding the bacteria from the sugar in his urine.
Oh, God.
So I cut out all sugars dramatically, and the pain levels started going down and down and down and down and down. It was gone as the bacteria died.
That's I'm glad it got sorted, but it doesn't sound nice. Pat, we have about 5 minutes left, and I want to actually, there's a couple of questions on the chat room there. I'm going to quick fire them over to you there. Tash wants to know, is it true that if a certain amount of people deregister their vote, that it returns our power to change our government?
Listen, in theory, yes, because there's not enough people voting. But the existing system will go along with the number of votes that are cast and say the majority won.
Yeah.
And it might be 100 people who are voting, but if 51 of them win for Fianna Fáil, well, Fianna Fáil is now in power with 51 votes countrywide.
Exactly.
That's what they do. They will not do it. They make their own rules. Look, ladies and gentlemen, it's like we are trying to win a game in an away match on their pitch with their ref, with their umpires, with their goalposts that are made of rubber, and with their management and their rules.
Yeah.
Now, try and win. It's not going to happen.
Exactly. It's not going to
work.
Okay.
The real world, yes, technically, but no. Okay. Sorry, not in the real world. Yeah, go ahead. Next question.
John wants to know, as stated by HSE and others, they say COVID affects coloured people more. So if they give them the vaccine, maybe a vitamin injection, so no adverse reactions, will this make them line up for vaccine?
They say the COVID affects coloured people more. I would suggest that if that is the case, I'm not familiar with it, it would be because they have their black skin would lower their vitamin D levels in this part of the world.
Yeah.
And vitamin D is part of the hydroxychloroquine protocol. Yeah. The vitamin D and zinc and the hydroxychloroquine. Okay. So if they give them the vaccine, maybe a vitamin injection, so no adverse reactions, will this make them line up for vaccine? It's kind of I'm not quite sure what was being asked there, Joan, if you could clarify it. But the giving them a vitamin injection of vitamin D would certainly help their situation if it was intravenous. You can also take what's called liposomal vitamin D, and you can make that at home. There are protocols, there's ways and methods of doing that at home with very simple off-the-shelf ingredients. You may need to get a particular item, which would be the jewellery cleaners, the ones at high frequency. They use sound.
The ultra cleaners. Yeah.
Yeah, you'd need one of them to create your own liposomal vitamin D or vitamin C, whichever you require. You can do that at home relatively cheaply.
Okay.
The adverse reactions, would be less if your immune system is stronger. Sorry, next question.
Okay, next question. Shane wants to know, do you think that telemedicine, online doctors, will change things as they can say what they want from anywhere in the world and will therefore are free to tell the truth?
No, they're not free to tell the truth. They'd be a teledoctor, but they'd be licensed to some organisation somewhere, and it'll only take the organisation in the country that you're advising. Say if somebody's in America or Canada or New Zealand and they're advising me on my medical protocols and somebody goes against the system, what they tend to do is that it will happen around 100-150 people here. One will get an adverse reaction and then they will spill the beans, and then the licensing authority here will ring the license authority there and have them removed. So no, it won't change.
Okay. And so, okay, tell us what's the plans for DDI? What's the future now? What's happening?
Well, we're in the middle of trying to regroup and reorganise. We're looking to relaunch DDI with a new look and a new way. We're even considering changing the name. It's a consideration. We're not too sure yet. So it's really just to reinvigorate DDI, but we're also going to stop looking at the bigger fish. In other words, TDs, which we've always looked at, but we'll concentrate more on the local level and get in at that level. There are two people who were members of DDI got into local authorities because they did the groundwork.
Yeah.
Now, since they got in, they haven't mentioned the words direct democracy. So,
I think you're right. I think you are right on a local level. I think what you should do, and this is just my idea from brainstorming, right? Say take a county like County Meath, right, and say, okay, let's break this down. Don't try, be sparse and have people, in different counties where it's going to be very difficult to get in. Take one county like County Meath and go, okay, we're going to focus our energy on this county alone and that's it. So whether it's DDI or whatever the party is, you've just blast that county for DDI, tell them what's going on, get people interested, and then get your foot on the ladder into the local council and get in there. And then obviously take County Louth next time, and then get in there and gradually, hopefully over time. Now, I don't know how long that would take, whether it could be sped up depending on the amount of people who's involved and who's going to be standing. But, there has to be kind of a guerrilla marketing campaign in one county. If everybody kind of sees the same face.
That's the approach we're taking.
Yeah.
I don't want to cut right across you, but the idea being is that it's more focused. And the idea, the concept of the Overton window has to be exploited so that we can get our message across, get in there, but there's no point in us or people like us going to meetings because they're controlled by the existing system.
Yeah.
We have to literally go door to door.
Yeah.
It's going to be a very, very hard slog, but it's the only way.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. Pat, thank you for coming on the show. Much appreciated. There's a few things that I have to go through and have an audio to play later as well. So a big thank you for coming on and good luck with everything you're doing. Do you want to give out any links or any information to the listeners? So if you want to have a look at DDI or anything like that, you can they can go off to a website and check it out.
What I'll do is I'll gather the information together and next week, please God, I'll put them up on the I'll put them up in the chat room.
Cool. And, yeah. Okay.
You can take it from there, and you can put it up then on whatever platform you want.
Brilliant stuff.
After that, yeah.
Okay, Pat. Well, listen. Okay. Thanks a lot for jumping on. Just stay with me there. I'm just going to go off to a musical break, and we'll be back after this.
Thanks, everyone.
You're listening to Alan James on Circle of White Light Radio and People's Internet Radio.
Okay, that was Pat Green, and that song was Hot House Flowers there. This is it. It was a song that Cormac wanted me to play. Now, I'm going to be playing a quick interview that I did with Cormac during the week. As I said at the start of the show, the Pay It Forward team, Cormac's part of the Pay It Forward team. What we do is when people donate to Circle of White Light or Pay It Forward, we allocate the donations to a charity of the choice of one of the team. So a team member might come in and go, in their locality, we have this charity and they need a little bit of funding. And so we'd allocate the funding to that. So for the November donation, the actual donation went to the Youth Suicide Prevention Ireland. So Cormac went down, met the lads, gave them the check, and he had to chat with them. And so this is Cormac just giving us some information regarding the charity and what they do there. I would like to introduce Cormac. Cormac is one of the members of the Pay It Forward team. And we get together once a week and we talk about things that are going on in the world and everything else. But also what we try and do is look for charities that we can donate to with the funds that come in to Circle of White Light and Pay It Forward. And as part of the team, one of the tasks is to look for these charities. For the November donation, Cormac selected a charity called Youth Suicide Prevention Ireland, which he's going to tell us all about. Good evening, Cormac. How are you?
How's it going, Alan?
Good stuff. Yeah, not too bad at all. Not too bad at all. Now, obviously, the charity that you donated to for November was a charity called Youth Suicide Prevention Ireland. Do you want to tell us all about it?
I will. I went down on Wednesday to Killarney and met with Alan and Tony, two really sound lads doing very important work down there in their office. And so we had a good chat for about an hour. And I suppose over the last few days, they gave me some literature, and which is what I've been going through. So I just thought I'd give you a few kind of facts about it. Give us something to all to think about, I suppose. So
okay, because obviously, I'll just say that as we all know, suicide is very high in Ireland. But we tend to think a lot of the time, I think most people relate suicide generally to adults more so than children. Yes, we know kids do commit suicide, but it's more when we think of suicide, we think of adults. But this charity that you were donating to, it takes care of young people who commit suicide.
It does. And you know what came up for me anyway was that some of it rang a lot of bells, you know, especially talking to them. It's such a kind of tragic subject. I really have to take my hat off to the two lads that have to kind of sit in an office and deal with this stuff every day, you know. But we used to be adolescents too. What I've started to think of is that, you know, I can relate to a lot of these feelings that are in their literature and stuff. And maybe we made it through basically the adolescent area. But and also that adolescents grow up to be adults too. And I'll tell you about some of the things that I'm learning from their literature pretty much. So I'll just start off with the fact here that According to research by UNICEF published in 2017, so this is a few years ago, Ireland has the fourth highest teen suicide rate in the EU. Now, it says the organization's latest report card on well-being of young people found that Ireland's suicide rate amongst adolescents aged between 15 to 19 was 10.3 per 100,000 population. Now, that sounds like a pandemic to me. You know what I mean? Especially with what's going on.
Well, we do say that there's been more suicides in Ireland than people who died of the COVID virus.
Yeah. And that's all there factual in the CSO, is it the statistics organization? So it is. So Tony and Alan, anyway, they came up with the Four Steps to Help program, and they're not counselors because it's such a kind of a touchy subject that way. I mean, there is qualified counselors that need to be on the job and to help people with severe tendencies, you know. But the two lads, anyway, go around to schools. They were doing a lot of their work going around to schools. But since the lockdown, now they're restricted to Zoom calls. And it was quite a pity, actually, because while they were going around to schools and colleges, they were hitting like two or 300 students at once kind of thing in one hall. And now it's down limited. So, you know, and since the lockdown too, they're also four times as busier. The phone is going off four times more than it used to be. So, but I'll just tell you about their Four Steps to Help program. It's been developed and approved by an advisory panel, which includes a consultant child and adolescent psychiatrist, and has been deemed to be age appropriate for ages 16 plus. So there is no cost to book and host a talk, if you know what I mean. They go out and do that by themselves. So it's designed to increase the awareness of suicide prevention and to provide information on the support and resources available to anyone who's concerned about suicide. Now that's what they do normally, and now they've developed a great website, by the way. It's called ineedhelp.ie, and they were showing me some of it. And it's they're really doing a great job, and it's really well set up. And if any people want to go and have a look at that to see how easy they've made it, not how it's easy, but the best they're doing and the services they're providing. There's also a free text service, and that's it's free of charge from any network, and you can text this number even if you have no credit. And that's, you just text HELP, the word HELP, to 50015, and it's fully confidential, and it's all above board. But these are our small kind of services. But I was asking them a lot about, you know, when you're not qualified, obviously, or the donations, by the way, go to a crisis counselling fund.
Okay.
And that just provides two counselling sessions, the initial two counselling sessions for someone or for families that don't have the means to pay for their services. So that's where the donations are going. And obviously people do need to see counsellors and stuff like that. So, but there's a lot of things that we could do ourselves without being qualified, if you know what I mean. And that's just as a society and as friends and as people. So let me just find here. It's a thing. It's on their program. Active listening, it's called.
Did they give you any numbers regarding the difference between boys and girls and suicide in Ireland?
It does actually mention a little bit now, and I've been reading through the booklet, but it does say somewhere that men are more successful suicides.
That's right. I did hear that some people say men commit suicide more than women, but it's actually the same. It's just that men are more successful in doing it.
Yeah. it's in here somewhere. Maybe it's kind of a it's a fairly great, it's great literature they have on it. But what can we do for people that, like, the main thing is about making people aware and kind of looking at the signs for either their teenagers, but I think it goes across the board at this stage, even into adults and stuff, because what came up for me was that there's a type of a phenomena called it's called the dangerous cam, and it's about it's kind of a psychological defense mechanism that someone that is having suicidal tendencies or thoughts, they put it in there, they put it into themselves as an option. They kind of shelf it, you know. So the signs, people would be looking out for change of character and, you know, loss of interest and severe kind of changes like this. But yeah, teenagers can shelf the idea as in, might sound a bit crude, but look, if it all doesn't work out, I can always go and kill myself, because they've come to the kind of edge and they just said, not now, but we'll shelf it. And that can be dormant for years, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Those kind of thoughts. And that's why I'm saying, like, that we were adolescents once, and, you know, it's still active. It can be active in adults is just as much.
It's just strange that looking back at when I was younger, it's not something that I ever came across. Very rarely would you hear it. Now, I know we have the internet and everything else, social media, which is a big change. You know, you hear all the time, you know, the big change from what we used to have.
Yeah.
But it's something that was very rare that you heard about. And now it seems to be so prolific in society. Both, you know, kids and adults, with everything going on.
And in every town. In every town.
It was... I think the statistics the other day was Meath and Monaghan, or Cavan and Monaghan, there was 18 suicides in 16 days. I mean, that's phenomenal.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. And the lads were saying that there's two things you've kind of brought up there. Rural settings are kind of rural places where there's so-called not much stuff to do. Can be hot, kind of, you know, can be a lot of numbers. There's also issues of another new psychological thing is that it can become kind of a trend.
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah.
Like that young people, young adolescents in despair when they see someone's funeral and they see the send off, or the emotion and all that, it can actually kind of set a line in the sand if people are, if they're having the same trouble, you know, the same issues. But I mean, what can we do as, like, brothers, parents, anything, uncles, nieces, everything, is the act of listening. And it's about a non-judgmental, like, leave them, you have to make them kind of feel comfortable, not to be judging them. And the lads were even telling me that even giving advice, you know, you don't argue with them, obviously, but even like things like you have so much to live for, or your suicide will hurt your family. Like, these things could not be the way that they're feeling. You know, they mightn't agree with those type of things.
Yeah. Well, I think their mindset and their where they're at the moment, that's the last thing they're probably thinking of. But again, you have to be kind of very, very careful and treat them with kid gloves, because maybe something you say might trigger them as well. So you have to be aware of that. But we're just finishing up on dealing with the charity. So the donation was given over, which is great. You nominated the charity. Well done, Cormac. Thanks for doing that. And I'm sure we'll probably come across the charity again. And maybe down the road we'll do another donation if we have the funds to do that. Do you want to just say something quickly before we finish up?
I suppose we just awareness. There's your show is all about solutions, Alan, and trying to find solutions to things. So
that's right.
We need to put heads together and do. There's a lot of simple things that we can do just to even to raise the awareness and to try to help. You know, we can just, if we come together, necessarily the government mightn't do it. You know, the government, I don't think, are capable of looking after things as such, and it's more vital now than ever, especially when the debts and the rates are so high, you know.
Well, yeah, totally. I do agree. It's going to be down to people power, and that's what Pay It Forward is all about. We can only do and donate to the charities that we nominate with the money that comes in from the listeners and the people who donate to Pay It Forward. So for everybody listening to this show, you know, €1 a month is what we really ask for. If you want to donate more, that's great, but €1 a month would be fantastic. And, you know, we can actually try and help the situation with people power. We don't need the government to do it, and we'd appreciate if you can afford it. We know money's tight and things are tight at the moment with everything going on. But if people can't donate to Pay It Forward, if you go to the website, circleofwhitelight.com, and click on the Pay It Forward menu option, the option is there that you can donate.
You're listening to Alan James on Circle of White Light Radio and People's Internet Radio.
So, folks, that was just a quick interview with Cormac. I know we could have probably done it probably an hour talking about that, but we just wanted to have a little snippet of the charity and what was going on. A big thank you to Cormac, who went down, met the lads down there in the charity and passed over the check. And a big thanks to everybody who donates to Circle of White Light and Pay It Forward. That's where the money's going. If you want to find out more information about that charity, pop over to the circleofwhitelight.com website and click on Pay It Forward, and it's actually on there. If you click on there, you can read about the charity, and there's information on there if you know kids that are potentially, you know, you're concerned about them in any way. It might be an idea to point them in that direction, or at least speak to the charity there. But thanks again to Cormac and the Pay It Forward team. Everybody on the team, as I say, is tasked to find a local charity to donate to. And it's thanks to everybody who does the donations that we can do that. Now, just a couple of things, just watching the time there. I need to read out. The first thing is, just going to be a COVID thing again, but something that you should know about. On Russia Today, it said the global team of experts has found 10 fatal flaws in the main test for COVID and is demanding it's urgently axed, as they should, by Peter Andrews, Irish science journalist and writer based in London. He has a background in the life sciences and graduated from the University of Glasgow with a degree in genetics. A peer review of the paper on which most COVID testing is based has comprehensively debunked the science behind it, finding major flaws. They can conclude it's utterly unsuitable as a means for diagnosis, and the fallout is immense. Last week, they reported on a landmark ruling from Portugal, where a court had ruled against a government health authority that had illegally confined four people to a hotel this summer. They had done so because one of the people had tested positive for COVID in a polymerase chain reaction PCR test, but the court had found the test fundamentally flawed and basically inadmissible. Now, the PCR testing supremacy under which we all now live has received another crushing blow. A peer review from a group of 22 international experts has found 10 major flaws in the main protocol for such tests. The report systematically dismantles the original study, called the Corman-Drosden paper, which described the protocol for applying the PCR technique to detecting COVID. The Corman-Drosden paper was published on January 23, 2020, just a day after being submitted, which would make any peer review process that took place possibly the shortest in history. What is important about it is because the protocol describes is used in around 70% of COVID kits worldwide. It's cheap, fast, and absolutely useless. So there you go. And I believe I read out last week that in Portugal, they've said that the PCR test is basically a waste of space. It doesn't, it's pointless using the PCR test. Even the guy who invented the PCR test said they shouldn't be used for the coronavirus. And what the Irish government are doing, it should be only amplified to 35, level 35. And the Irish government are apparently amplifying it to around 40 to 45, which obviously you'll find anything at 40 and 45. So it's just nuts. The Irish Freedom Party did post up on their Twitter page, Taoiseach Leo Varadkar has warned that there are a number of unknowns around new rushed vaccine, and it will not be possible to know what rare side effects exist until 1 million or 2 million people have taken vaccine. So we need, or they need, the Irish government need 2 million Irish people to take the vaccine, and then when, if and when, allegedly people might be affected by the vaccine, they'll go, oh, we better not use that because it's causing too many problems. Remember what happened to thalidomide in the 60s. They rolled out thalidomide for morning after sickness. And what happened? How many kids were destroyed and affected by thalidomide, with arms missing, legs missing and everything else? And then they pulled it off the shelf and they went, oh, we made a mistake, we better take that off. I tell you, I wouldn't be queuing up for that. No way. Okay, and the other thing, just somebody who's quite inventful regarding COVID. They said here that, so this guy says, I am still officially not allowed to open my pub, but estate agents are allowing to sell houses with viewings, etc. So I am officially putting my pub on the market as of tomorrow. Viewings are between 11 a.m. and 11 p.m. No appointment necessary, but you must buy a beer while viewing. I tell you, people get very inventive. I have to give them credit for that. They really do get inventive in ways to work around the system, because they know the system is wrong. And the last thing, we got a last minute message come in before the show started tonight. And I want to read this out. This is from Liam from the Arenda project, the Arenda restoration plan in Scotland. Liam was on a few weeks ago with Gavin, the quantum surgeon, and Liam, Gavin and Kim are doing fantastic work in the background, amazing work. They're dedicating so much of their time in doing so much energy work in the background. It's unreal, folks. You don't realise how much work is being done. And so Liam sent me out this, and he just wants everybody to be aware of this. He said, could you please ask everyone listening on your show to keep themselves in a high vibration as possible and shield up, as we are going to need as many as possible over the next 15 to 18 days. They don't have anything to worry about, but it will help a lot for the people that are doing the frontline energy work. As you all know, there's a lot of talk about the 21st of December. Now, I'm not going to get caught up in dates. If any of you have checked out the Schumann frequency, this week alone, it's off the charts. It's the highest it has ever been. So this, and that is, you're seeing that, there's the statistics there, you're actually seeing the evidence. The Schumann frequency has been the highest it's ever been. And I was affected by it on Wednesday, as was my son. It's affecting people in all different ways, and we got affected by it on Wednesday. But this week, it's been off the charts, up and down, and it's going to get probably more. It'll get worse. When I say worse, the energy will be coming in. You might be affected by it. You might have, depending, everybody's suffering in different ways, but it's just the frequencies coming in. So just be aware of that. Keep your frequencies high. You have this conjunction between, I think it's Saturn and Jupiter. I'm no astrologist, by the way, so I don't know much about it, but this alignment is happening, and it hasn't happened for, you know, thousands of years apparently, and it's going to have a major effect on the energies on the planet. So what I'm planning to do is, hopefully, now next week I have a lady that I've had on the show before called Becky Barron, and Becky tunes into energy, and we're going to have a talk with Becky. But the week after that, which is the Sunday before the 21st, I've asked Liam, Gavin and Kim to come on the show. And we're all going to have a round table chat about the energies and what's been taking place and the work that they've been doing and everything else. So that's going to be an interesting show as well. So it's all going on, folks. You know, as I say, at the start of the show, I could have a script, the unscripted script. I could have about 7 or 8 pages of information that I could read with everything going on. And I'm just trying to pick out the best things and give out the information so you know what's going on. But there's a lot to play for, and we'll see what happens by the end of this year. I'd like to think that, I mean, the playing cards are falling. We have won the fight. We have won the fight. But here's the problem. They don't give up. They just keep on going and going and going, thinking that, you know, if they keep on doing what they're doing, then they'll eventually get where they want to be. And it's just not working for them. They've been shut down left, right and centre. But this is the dying part of the animal, really, that which is the cabal. So we are winning, folks. I know it doesn't look like it, but we are winning. More and more people are waking up, and maybe this shift on the 21st of December, maybe it's just an energy shift where people will actually wake up and they see what was going on. They'll step outside the matrix and go, right, okay, let's see what's happening here. But keep your energy high as much as you can. And don't get into arguments with people with mask wearing and COVID. It's not worth it. It just pulls down your energy. Just say you're exempt or stay away from them. Look, you know, the amount of people that need to be woke up now, what's done is done, you know. So just take care of your own energy and keep a high and be around people who vibrate at the same frequency as you. Okay, I think Barry might be up on PIR after me. That's all from me tonight. I hope you enjoyed the show. Thanks again for the people who donating. Thanks to people who logged into the chat room on the two chat rooms and Cormac and what he did. And I'll be speaking to the PIF team on Wednesday. I know it's funny, paid forward PIF, but hey, you know, might get a t-shirt with PIF Power or something on it, something like that. Anyway, have a good week. If you have any information of interest, send it over to me. Remember, don't just send me a link on email. Send some information with it as well. And if there's anything of interest, let me know. Any guests that you want me to get on. I'm now fully booked for the rest of the year. So I'm actually beginning to book for next year as well for the show. So thanks to everybody. And take care of yourself and have a good week. And we'll catch you next week. Bye bye.
You have been listening to Circle of White Light Radio on CircleOfWhiteLight.com, focusing on solutions and thinking different.